From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Well, actually, I was born into it, I think. I was born in New Orleans with an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar on another, and the Nazi party was on the third corner. And my father, at 4 years old, explained to me that white supremacy was a sickness. And you don't get upset with sick people, you don't get mad with them. You know that God made of one blood all the nations of the world. And they don't know that, but you can't help them to see it if you're gonna act like they act, or if you're gonna ever get angry. And my first lesson at four, and I remember because it was 1936, and that was when Jesse Owens in the Berlin Olympics, and that was the lesson he took me to see how Jesse Owens dealt with Hitler. And so it was just, I've always known that I was blessed, and I've always heard that to them to whom much has been given, of them is much required.
Andrew Young, civil rights legend and former UN ambassador, congressman, and mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. This past spring, the LBJ Presidential Library on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin hosted the Summit on Race in America, Liberty and Justice for All. The seminar event explored our nation's continual racial divide and struggle for racial equality. It featured civil rights icons, esteemed leaders, activists, musicians, comedians, and other artists for open and candid discussions on the failures, progress, and challenges our nation faces on race today. Through conversation, performances, film clips, and presentation, the summit took on several of the issues of our time, including voting rights, immigration, movement building, economic empowerment, and the portrayal of race through the media. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a conversation with two civil rights legends, Dr. Dolores Huerta and Andrew Young, in Black America.
We're living in a global economy, and we still only have a national vision. And everybody wants things to be national, but it cannot be. And we were moving in the right direction, I think. And I think that science and technology is global, but our politics is still national. And you don't, I mean, I don't want to call a name, but but nobody reflects this conflict of interest more than our national leadership that has a nationalist vision, but all of their economics is global.
In March of 1965, President Lyndon Baines Johnson began his appeal to America to support the Voting Rights Act with the words, "I speak tonight on the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy." His appeal for voting rights was heard across America, and he viewed the securement a sacred trust in America's quest towards equal rights for all of its citizens. But as LBJ knew, the destiny of democracy is not preordained. It is in the hands of every generation of Americans, with a charge to leave it stronger for the next. The salvation of history must be learned in our times. Today, despite the strides made towards civil rights, racism and bigotry has flared alarmingly, threatening to compromise our nation's dignity, erode our democracy, and define the next era of our country's evolution. On today's program, two civil rights legends lend their knowledge on this clarion call. Dolores Huerta, founder and president of the Dolores Huerta Foundation, and Andrew Young, former UN ambassador, congressman, and mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, were the opening guests at the Summit on Race in America. Mark Updegrove, president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation, moderated the discussion.
Well, what a way to begin this summit. We are truly honored to have you here at the Summit on Race in America. And I want to, we live in a city that has boulevards, as so many other cities do, named for Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King. And I wonder if we could start off by talking about how you got involved in the movements that have defined your lives. And Dolores, we'll start with you. How, in the mid-1950s, did you get swept up in the labor movement?
Well, actually, I was organized by a great gentleman named Fred Ross Sr., who invited me to a house meeting where he explained to us how in East Los Angeles they were able to bring in streetlights and sidewalks and clinics. And actually, the thing that really hooked me, how they sent police to prison for beating up Mexican-American young people. And I thought, that's a lot of power. How can you kind of create that kind of power to make changes in the community? And we started working on many pieces of legislation, including getting voting ballots in Spanish, driver's licenses in Spanish, getting public assistance for people who were illegal immigrants to the country, and changing the voter registration laws so that people who were citizens could register another person to vote. Unlike Texas, where you still have to find a deputy registrar somewhere to register you. And then at that point in time, they had a lot of people from Mexico under a HTA program, and the farm workers were treated very, very badly. And the domestic workers, the local farm workers, their wages had dropped so low to 50 cents an hour. And people were living in really terrible conditions. And so once I learned that you can change things by bringing people together and taking direct action, I thought, that's what I want to do for my life, and I'm still doing it.
For which we are profoundly grateful. Mr. Ambassador, how did you get involved in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference where you worked with Dr. King?
Well, actually, I was born into it, I think. I was born in New Orleans with an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar on another, and the Nazi party was on the third corner. And my father, at 4 years old, explained to me that white supremacy was a sickness. And you don't get upset with sick people, you don't get mad with them. You know that God made of one blood all the nations of the world. And they don't know that, but you can't help them to see it if you're gonna act like they act, or if you're gonna ever get angry. And my first lesson at four, and I remember because it was 1936, and that was when Jesse Owens in the Berlin Olympics, and that was the lesson he took me to see how Jesse Owens dealt with Hitler. And so it was just, I've always known that I was blessed, and I've always heard that to them to whom much has been given, of them is much required. And I drifted around in the South and went north for a while, National Council of Churches, and then came back to Atlanta, and I was put in an office right across the hall from Martin Luther King. And I was working for the United Church of Christ. And his secretary said, look, you're here by yourself. Your wife's over in Alabama. You're going to get in trouble in Atlanta if you don't find something to do in the evenings. And my suggestion is that you take some of Dr. King's mail home with you and you help him answer his letter mail. And so I started off answering an egg crate full of mail.
Wow.
And he didn't know me, and I'd met him, but he had a similar background. Mm. He was from a privileged family. His daddy was a banker, as well as a preacher. And his grandfather was the president of, was the treasurer of the National Baptist Convention, which had 6 million members. So it was understood from birth that he had to lead something. And that he was born to lead. And he ran from it and did everything he could to avoid it. In fact, he went to Montgomery thinking that this is the sleepiest, quietest, most conservative town in the South, and I can just be a pastor and mind my own business. Well, you
then
know
Rosa Parks got on
it.
A bus, right?
Yeah.
We have seen setbacks in recent years. And we've seen an undeniable rise in white supremacy, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world. Ambassador, you're from Louisiana, and just in the last 2 weeks, we've seen three historically black churches bombed. We saw what happened at the mosque in New Zealand last month. What do you think has led to this rise in white nationalism?
I blame everything on the economy. That we're living in a global economy, and we still only have a national vision. And everybody wants things to be national, but it cannot be. And we were moving in the right direction, I think. And I think that science and technology is global, but our politics is still national. And you don't, I mean, I don't want to call a name, but but nobody reflects this conflict of interests more than our national leadership that has a nationalist vision, but all of their economics is global. Mm-hmm. And all of their money comes from somewhere else.
Yeah. Doris, what's your view? Why have we seen this spike in white supremacy?
Well, I think it's both. I think it is the economy. And I think in the 60s and 70s, we had what I call a cultural revolution. But I think this next revolution, evolution that we're in, has to be an economic evolution, because we have this huge disparity of wealth, where you have 1% of the wealthy families own 50% of the wealth, and 10% of the wealthy corporations and families own 50% of the wealth in the United States of America. But I also think it has a lot to do with education, and that we haven't been able to, or even tried, I think, to eliminate racism. And the reason I say it's part of our education, because we do not teach our children, starting with kindergarten, the real history of the United States of America. And we do not teach them that Native Americans, who were victims of genocide in our land, but they were the first slaves. And we do not teach our children that African slaves built Washington, D.C., the White House and the Congress, and all of those federal buildings over there. And all of the immigrants that came here, people from Mexico, from the Asia, the Philippines, China, Japan, India, all of these people of color that came here to build this country. And so I think our children of color, they never get that dignity that they deserve. And our white children, our Anglo children, still have that poison of white supremacy and white privilege. And I think that that's one thing that we have to do to eliminate racism. And then, of course, the fallout then comes when the resources are allocated in our country. And we're the richest country in the world. And there is no reason why we shouldn't have more equity, more equality in education in the way that the resources are allocated. There's no reason why we shouldn't have free college tuition for everybody, free health care for everyone, like they have in the Scandinavian countries, like they have in Cuba, which is a small country that has an economic boycott. And I don't think that we have really put forth the will and the intention to eliminate racism. And I think racism is used to keep the country divided. And not just racism, but when you talk to gender equality, women's reproductive rights, the inclusion and equality for our LGBT community, and unless those issues are addressed, well, they can divide people and keep people separated. And in the meantime, nobody's paying attention to what's happening with the economy, you know, because we're so busy fighting each other down here at this level, and we can see that the wealth of our country is not being distributed the way that it should by all of our citizens in this country.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America.
I want to go back to you mentioned education. We are not teaching our kids about minorities in history. There have been efforts in a number of states, including this one, to essentially suppress those stories. And you have said when you deny them their stories, you deny them their power. How do we ensure that the stories of minorities are being taught in our public schools?
Well, I think taking over school boards, taking over the Department of Education, putting in those curriculums, I think every child should see the story of Emmett Till, a young man who was killed in Mississippi because he was supposedly was a little white woman. And they have to see the story of Matt Shepard, a young gay student who was killed because he was gay. You know, and the story is also, you know, we're in Texas right now, but I like to say to people, someday when you have time, Google and see what the map of the United States looked like before 1847. And it's a shocker when you look and you see a third of the United States was Mexico. You know, a third of the United States was Mexico. And all of that suppression and discrimination against Latinos and African American people in the state of Texas, that all comes from slavery, it comes from domination, it comes from occupation.
I'm the optimist, though. I refuse to think that we're slipping back. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that we were so close that I was with Dr. King when President Johnson said, "We shall overcome." And we were sitting in Selma, and I saw tears drip down his eyes because we were almost there. And the next election, we lost by one vote per precinct. And we've been looking for a message ever since. I think President Johnson was the icing on the cake that Franklin Roosevelt started baking. And then all of a sudden, we slip back. And we slip back politically because it takes 60% of the population to make change politically. But medicine is going ahead. Technology is making rapid rise. My symbol of the future is an ad. I don't know whether it's been here in Texas, but it's a cancer cell being eaten up by another cancer cell. And it says how far technology has taken us. Now, we just have not been able to get, well, and to keep it from being racial, and I don't want to make it racial, I want it not to be racial. It's all white folks between Brexit and Europe. You know, I mean, that's got nothing to do with race. That is England, well, I don't know what they want, but they can't have it, see? It doesn't exist anymore. Now, Germany has been different, and we have 4,000 German companies in Georgia because Germany realized that they were too big for Europe. And one of the things I started working on when I was mayor was getting people who were growing too big for their own countries to come here. Now, that's also true of, I mean, almost everybody here is an immigrant, except us. And maybe we are too, coming, you know, and so making sense of this complicated world is going to take a little time, but it's happening, I think. And the thing that messes up the politics is not only the slogans and the needs, but it's when I put all my money into television, somebody advised me that I lost. When I kept the money and started knocking on doors and organizing people block by block, I haven't lost a race since.
All right.
But television cannot change the hearts and minds of people, and I think that's where we have been missing out.
I want to come back to the issue of immigration in a moment, Dolores, but I want to ask my fellow African, Ambassador Young. You said last year, "I'm frankly worried about white people. They blame their poverty on our success." What did you mean by that?
Well, you turn on your television set, and you know, and Monday night, it's all black people. Tuesday night, it's kind of mixed. Wednesday night, it's Empire. You know, and you go to a football game, you go to a basketball game. I mean, I can't root for Virginia here in Texas, but I like to see white boys playing basketball. You know, that they shouldn't give up. But if you don't have those opportunities, and if you don't have the kind of coaching and the kind of thing that's open public, you begin to feel like this used to be. My daddy was an All-American, but that was before integration, you know. And I can't be an All-American now. But those are necessary adjustments that you become something else. And the world is expanding. But I enjoyed the Country Music Festival last night. And I love country music because I want to understand. I can understand. See, I think the song of the year was something about Bear My Burdens. I identify with that. That could be black or white. It was wonderful when Ray Charles and Willie Nelson did Georgia as a duet. That we've got to work on things like that. Our families don't just get along without help. And we've got a huge family. And the leadership, instead of bringing us together, is dividing us.
So can you remedy that at a grassroots level, Mr. Ambassador? How do you remedy that resentment among a wide swath of the white population?
Well, in a city like Atlanta, you make sure that you never, I mean, the majority of the population seems to be black. It's not. It's just that the politics is black. So you make sure you do not have a committee that doesn't have every neighborhood represented on it. And it can be gay and straight, or white and black, or rich and poor, but you have to structure democracy so that it represents every facet of our society.
I think it has to be intentional. It has to be very, very intentional, as you said, to make sure that everybody is represented. And that it's absolutely the issue of race, but I think it's also the issue of gender, of women, and also of our LGBT community. And you know, I have been quoting Coretta Scott King a lot, and she had a statement that said that we will never have peace in the world until women take power. But I have amended Coretta's statement to say we will never have peace until feminists take power, because we know that not all women support reproductive rights, right, or immigrants' rights, or environmental issues, etc. And so, and that's why I have amended that. But I think it's so I think that. But Reverend Young was just saying it's got to be intentional. That's what I meant when I say that every public and private institution has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. To make sure that people of color are included at all levels, and that women are included, and LGBT people are included at all levels.
You're fond of quoting a friend of yours from Stanford who said, "We didn't cross the border, the border crossed us." What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said before about this all being part of Mexico, you know, like my family, I was born in New Mexico, right. You know, and my grandparents were born in the state of New Mexico, so they were already there when they made this the border across the Mexican border. But the other thing is, it applies to everybody because we are all the American continent. And you know, before people would travel all the way from Peru all the way to New Mexico, they have found relics there of chocolate that were in clay vessels. And people went back and forth. There was no border. And hopefully someday it'll be like John Lennon's song, Imagine. You know, but we will have no borders and no wars. Yeah.
There was a, and Doris, you said, I want to get both of you to comment on this. You've said that in the 1960s, there was an ambiance that you could change the world. There was this kind of intersectionality between movements. They were aligned and synergies came to bear in the movements. Do you see that spirit today? This is a question for both of you. Do you see that spirit today? Are there movements that are lining up where there are synergies toward social change?
Yeah, I see it and I'm afraid of it. Because the movement, I mean, we had a hard time getting along with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We got along pretty good with CORE, because they were based on nonviolence, but the Urban League was business-oriented, and the NAACP was legally. And think of the clash between Martin Luther King advocating civil disobedience and Thurgood Marshall going to the Supreme Court. And he'd been working on that since the early 40s. And here we come along in the 60s with a challenging laws. It's really very complicated. Now, A. Philip Randolph held us together during that period. But it's very hard now. And I frankly think that we lost the last election because we were supporting candidates and not change. And now with so many candidates, it scares the hell out of me. And you know, I just pick one. And let's get behind her or him, and let's just move the country forward. And she doesn't have to be black, brown, or she has to have a message, or he has to have a message that brings us back into the leadership of the free world. The world cannot run without American vision. It just cannot do it. See, Europe and Latin America and Africa depend on a vision from the United States of America. And that vision requires all of us with all of our diversity coming together and finding a vision.
Andrew Young, civil rights legend and former UN ambassador, congressman, and mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.